need the United States economy to grow at over 2%. We need the U.S. economy to grow at 3%, especially with the growing deficits the federal government has. And so much of this money, not just the project, is going to be coming from the private sector, from savings accounts, from pension accounts, from insurance companies, and on and on and on.
That's right. BlackRock CEO Larry Fink just urged everyday citizens to think about growing with the United States, framing the plunder of retirement nest eggs as some kind of patriotic duty. Fink didn't mince words about the scale of the heist. The U.S. economy must accelerate from a sluggish 2% growth to a robust 3% just to handle ballooning federal deficits, and that money is going to be coming from the private sector, savings accounts, from pension accounts, and insurance companies. He painted a picture of exploding demand for electrons powering these data behemoths.
But as the governor was talking about, the need for electrons is growing every day. You know, if we're going to be the leader in technology, which we are, if we are going to be the leader in AI, which we presently are, it's just going to require trillions of dollars of investments. And if we don't invest in it, China will be the global leader in this.
Translation, your 401ks and IRAs aren't safe havens anymore. They're the piggy bank for BlackRock's vision of an AI-dominated future where trillions get redirected into projects that conveniently align with the asset manager's own massive holdings in data centers and energy infrastructure.
Residents were told today that actually we're not going to provide you electricity anymore. The Nevada-based power company that is providing electricity to the residents of Lake Tahoe informed them today that, sorry, all the electricity we make, every watt of power that we generate is going to have to go to a nearby data center, and therefore you have until the end of next year to find a new source of electricity, and after that, we can't help you.
Thanks to the data center overlords, 49,000 residents, mostly on the California side of Lake Tahoe, are about to lose access to 75% of their electricity supply after May of 2027. Liberty Utilities is killing off 75% of the energy provided by NV Energy because NV Energy says it needs every megawatt for its own unprecedented data center growth. A massive international American tourist mecca packed with ski resorts, casinos, and 28 million visitors is getting squeezed by Google, Apple, Microsoft, and BlackRock. This is why we can't have nice things. Data centers already guzzled 22% of Nevada's electricity in 2024 alone and are cranking up to hit 35% by 2030 and a staggering 5,900 megawatts of demand by 2033. That's 2.8 times the entire output of the Hoover Dam.
We don't need another data center. You don't know what the health impact is. You got them all crunched together. You're going to have a mass exodus. You're going to ruin this community. You're going to ruin it. Ruin it if you let this continue.
Are you a member of a community where you've learned a data center is being proposed in your county? Have you decided to join your community in learning more about how this will impact farmland, the environment, your quality of life from the constant humming, noise, and light pollution? Are you concerned that your water may be drained by the data center or contaminated as we're seeing across the country? Well, you just might be a terrorist of some sort. According to 1,000 pages of unpublished reports from the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, and fusion centers, as reported by Wired.
The data center scam exposes the raw cynicism of the financial overlords at BlackRock, who manage trillions in ordinary Americans' hard-earned retirement funds while positioning themselves to profit handsomely from the very boom they're engineering at our expense. Fink's pitch isn't about national strength. It's a veiled demand to raid pensions for private gain, all while ordinary families foot the bill for skyrocketing energy costs, potential blackouts, and an unaccountable surveillance state powered by these AI fortresses designed to roll in the CBDC. This is how the Republic falls, one raided pension at a time.
I want to start with sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex.
This is Rocket Fuel.
This is incredible. This is rocket fuel. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. This is a cocktail I drink every day. A squirt of ultramethylene blue and T3. You are insane if you don't get it. Okay? Well, listen. You are insane if you don't get it. I am a wrecking ball. I am obsessed with this. I can't stop. And now I'm having this. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. This is the truth. Because I'm a sexual Tyrannosaurus Rex. You understand that? Does that burn into your brain?
I think I'm going to buy some methylene blue now.
DallasShow.com.
Welcome to the fourth hour of the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis. Today we're going to be talking about a hot topic that a lot of people speculate about. There's a lot of nonsense that's out there. And I'm going to give you some insights and some data pieces that most people also may not be aware of in regard to UFOs, aliens, Nephilim, and Genesis 6. So we're going to be talking about the text that the scriptures used, the biblical scriptural text, to talk about what happened in the fall and what happened with the fallen angels and certain types of fallen entities and angels, the watchers, and et cetera. And Alex has been talking about this pretty consistently the last several months due to the so-called UFO disclosure idea. I believe that this is largely a psyop. There's a lot of false information. But we're also going to talk about what the Bible does actually say, as well as the psyop angle as we move up into the present day. In Genesis 6, we read that it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, daughters were born to them. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, all of whom they chose. And the Lord said, "My spirit will not strive with man forever, for he is flesh, yet his days will be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and afterward the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men of old, the men of renown." And some translations talk about the giants, they talk about the titans, and I'm going to give you some passages that you may not be aware of or you may not care about, but there are other biblical texts that actually refer to this. Now, many people probably know about Jude. The book of Jude does say that the book of Enoch contains a prophecy of Christ. And of course, the entirety of the book of Enoch is about the watchers, the fallen angels, this desire that they had to leave their proper delineations and limitations as angelic beings and to try to seduce and have offspring with the daughters of men. And that led to, in part, the flood, as well as the wickedness of men on earth. So you have basically in church history and amongst the church fathers, two competing interpretations of this text. The earliest church fathers continue the Jewish tradition before them, which was the idea that it was talking about fallen angels. You have, for example, in the book of Job, the angels are called the sons of God. They meet in the heavenly divine council in the book of Job, and they have these discussions with God about ruling the universe. And so in the biblical perspective, this is called the divine council. You see this throughout the Psalms where the angelic entities participate with God in the governance of the universe. So yes, it's true that God could rule the universe directly without any angelic hierarchies, but he also chose to not do it that way. He chose to have a choir of angels. The tradition of the church and the tradition of the Bible includes the idea of nine different choirs, right? Thrones, principalities, powers, dominions, et cetera. There's a whole ranking of these. And we have this idea that some of these angelic beings fell from their proper limitation and their proper abode, according to the book of Jude. But did you know that there's a lot of mentions, maybe four mentions about this in what's called the Deuterocanonical text. And the Deuterocanon is the extra text that are the intertestamental books and the wisdom texts that are included in the Catholic and Orthodox Bible that are not typically in the Protestant Bible. The reason for that is a whole other issue, but the Protestant reformers wanted to go back to what they thought was the rabbinic canon, although, of course, Jesus established apostles for the church, not rabbis. And so it's actually the apostolic tradition that tells us what the canon of scripture is for the church. And the apostles, for the most part, including St. Paul primarily, used the deuterocanonical text. That's the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And that's known as the Septuagint. The Septuagint includes all of the deuterocanonical texts. That's why you see many cases in the New Testament where Paul and the other apostles, and even Christ himself, they refer to and reference the deuterocanonical texts many times over, the Book of Wisdom, the Book of Sirach, etc., Baruch. All of these texts are actually, in the Orthodox and Catholic tradition, part of the Bible. And they were used extensively by the early Christians, and that's why the rabbinic canon was a canonical decision by the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century rabbinic Jews who rejected Christianity. They said, well, the Christians are using these deuterocanonical texts so much, we're going to not even have them in our rabbinic canon. So Protestants don't know this, but they're actually just following the rabbinic canon, not the canon of the early church. So these passages, interestingly, that the deuterocanon utilizes refer to the giants as the titans. For example, we have in the book of Sirach, the Wisdom of Sirach, it says, recounting the history of the Jews in chapter 16, verse 7, in the congregation of sinners, a fire will be kindled. An unbelieving nation and wrath shall come out. The ancient giants did not obtain pardon for their sins. They were destroyed because they trusted in their own strength. So here, the fall of the wicked, the fall of Lucifer, is likened to the fall of the angels in Genesis 6, who didn't keep their proper abode and are likened to entities, or they're likened to beings that will forever be punished because of their pride. Likewise, in the book of Baruch, which is another one of the deuterocanonical texts that is worth referencing in this regard, Baruch talks about in book 3, verse 24, Baruch says, O Israel, the great nation, house of God, how vast are the territories he possesses. The house of Israel is great and knows no bounds. It is high and immeasurable. The titans, the giants, were born there. They were famous of old. They were great in stature and they were expert in war. However, God did not choose them to give them the way of knowledge. They perished because they didn't have wisdom. They perished through their folly. And there are other texts I'll mention as well. At the end of the book of Judith, which is kind of similar to the book of Esther or other stories that you might be familiar with if you're a Protestant. In the book of Judith, chapter 16, it says, the Lord is almighty and he thwarted them. By the hand of a woman, their mighty man did not fall. But by the hand of a woman. For their mighty man did not fall by our young men, nor did the titans or their sons strike them down, nor did giants attack them. But Judith, the daughter of Merari, who was beautiful in appearance, disabled him. So you'll notice that the destruction of this evil king in the story is likened to the destruction of the giants and their pride in terms of opposing the one true God. Because if you're familiar with the Book of Enoch, and this seems to, again, be referencing texts like the Enoch tradition, in the Book of Enoch, the giants and the offspring of these entities, they want to set up the rival interpretation of how to worship God, and they want to be worshiped. And so they begin to require things like human sacrifice. They require things like cannibalism. They require the sacrifice of the firstborn. All the things that the Levitical law will later forbid, right? When you read Leviticus, it talks about the Israelites coming into the land, and it says, when you go into the land and you see the practices of the people that are there, I want you to get rid of all that, wipe it all out, because it's an aberration. And that's because, according to this interpretation or this tradition, the idea of the demons beginning to require human sacrifice, cannibalism, all of these terrible practices that the Israelites in the Old Testament are continually tempted to fall back into. For example, in Numbers, the Israelites are tempted at Baal Peor. And Baal Peor is something very akin to what you find in modern tantrism, modern tantric Buddhism, or Crowley's philosophy, Aleister Crowley, the famous atheist, the famous Satanist, that philosophy includes the ingesting of various bodily fluids. And so at Baal Peor in the Book of Numbers, the Israelites are tempted with the ingesting and the partaking of bodily fluids. Baal Peor means Lord of open holes, and you can figure out what kind of holes we're talking about here. So this idea of menstrual, fecal, et cetera, cannibal type ingestion isn't something that occultists or Satanists came up with. It's actually the ancient world's entire religious practice. But why? Where would this come from? Why would we get some just such a disgusting, bizarre idea for how demons or entities are to be worshipped? Well, lo and behold, according to this story, it's actually the origin of the Watchers and their inversion and the type of worship that they enact, which is intended to defile and to deface the idea of God's worship, where human beings are created in his image. And so they have an honor and a dignity. They are actually intended, according to St. Paul in the Corinthians, in the resurrection, he says, we will be raised higher than the angels. We will actually judge the angelic beings, according to St. Paul. So humans have a very high destiny in the Christian tradition, the authentic Christian tradition. This is why, for example, the Eastern Church Fathers have always said that we are actually the source of the fall, because Satan was envious of man. Satan, being an angelic being, didn't feel like man should be raised to that level of power and authority in the resurrection, which was always the intention that God had. And so it's through envy that the devil fell and then sought to continually destroy and deface and bring down humanity and mankind. And so he is, of course, the angel of death for that reason. But in this tradition, we have this additional information that these sons of God who rebelled and became these imprisoned watchers and their offspring that became these entities or aberrations that began to require these inverted and degenerate practices, just because the flood happened or just because these things kind of went away for a period, the same spiritual degeneracy continues to manifest. And so all throughout the Old Testament, you have a continual temptation for the Israelites to return to these types of practices, which were originally forbidden in the book of Leviticus when it comes to the practices of the land. This also helps to explain why there was such a strong inclination to cleanse the land at that time. A lot of people think that, oh, this was unfair, it was mean. Well, it's not unfair and mean if you have these practices as the norm and these cultures need to be removed so that you can have the return of God's law being practiced, the moral law. And that's really what was going on, although the Israelites continued to fail at that endeavor. As we know throughout the entire Old Testament history, it's a story of repetitive falls and returns to the land and falls, and this cycle continues. This is the very cycle of Genesis and the fall, and then coming back to the land and being restored in a new generation. All of that cycle continues all throughout the Old Testament until it culminates in the crucifixion of the Messiah. And so Rabbinic Judaism ends up being kind of the culmination of that Antichrist spirit, and that's why the New Testament many times over calls that emerging rabbinic tradition, which even existed at the time of Jeremiah, because Jeremiah says that the scribes and the lawyers are beginning to taint and change the law. Not that the scriptures themselves were destroyed or edited, because we have ancient texts and ancient manuscripts that verify the veracity of the Bible and the Old Testament, but rather the tradition that was emerging amongst the rabbis and the Pharisees. That is the tradition that we have in rabbinic Judaism to this day. That is why Judaism is, much like Islam, ultimately very antithetical to the Christian tradition. Now, Judaism is a little more openly antithetical to Christianity. Islam gives the impression that it's friendly to Christians and people of the book, but that's actually not true, because if you read other sections of the Quran, Muslims are also told to wipe out idolaters, and the Trinity is considered to be an idolatrous doctrine. So there's no real friendship or alliance there, though many Muslims sort of pretend that that's the case. But it's also the case with rabbinic Judaism as well. Rabbinic Judaism is also, as many of you probably know, Talmudic. And ultimately, it's not a Bible-based religion. It's an oral Talmudic tradition-based religion, which puts the Talmudic tradition up and above in the lens through which you interpret the divine revelation of the Old Testament. So once you understand that, that's why it doesn't make any sense to talk about Judeo-Christian, because that'd be like saying the Islamo-Christian tradition. It doesn't make any sense. It's a religion that's set up in antithesis to the fundamentals of Christian theology. It's the same with Rabbinic Judaism as well. So this idea that, well, you got to choose between Zionism or between Islam is all retarded. It's all preposterous. They're both wrong. And that's the whole reason why Christianity exists as the continuation of the true Hebrew tradition. In the Christian view, the Old Testament is proto-Christian, right? The Hebrew tradition is a proto-Christian tradition. It's not the same thing as the later 4th, 5th, 6th century rabbinic codification, which was itself defined in antithesis to Christianity at that time. So when we understand these things, a lot of this begins to make more sense, and then it begins to make no sense as to why we would follow John Hagee and these kinds of, Huckabee and all these weirdos who have absolutely no idea about Christian tradition and history and actual biblical theology. They're really just indoctrinated into a Christian Zionism. But that's not today's topic. I want to get back to Genesis 6 and the aliens. And so when we get into the early church fathers period, the first and second century church fathers tend to agree with the already existing Jewish tradition at that time. And by Jewish tradition, I mean, generally speaking, not just talking about the rabbinic tradition, because these are emerging traditions that are beginning to part ways in the first, second, and third century. So the early church fathers like St. Justin Martyr and people like Irenaeus, they would tend to favor this view that, yeah, it's definitely talking about aberrant offspring from the fallen angels. But by the time you get to St. Augustine and other, third, fourth, fifth century church fathers, there begins to be more of a skeptical attitude towards this. Now, of course, we couldn't say that St. Augustine is some sort of a rationalist, because he also talks in many places about incubi and succubi in the City of God. So it's not like he was just a scientific skeptic about the attitude towards Genesis 6, but he began to think that, well, maybe Genesis 6 is just talking about the righteous sons of Abel and not talking about angelic beings, right? So sons of God there being the Christians or the proto-Christians of that time, the believers of that time, who were tempted to intermarry with unbelieving pagan women. And so in that sense, it's reinterpreted and revised to mean, like Paul says, don't marry an unbeliever if you can avoid that, right? He advises against that. But that's very late in the game, right, when that begins to be questioned. And then that tradition becomes more and more normative in the Middle Ages. I think probably in the Latin West, I'm just going from memory, but probably becomes dominant in the Latin West. It's never really addressed in a dogmatic way, I don't think, by the Eastern or the Western tradition. It's just kind of left kind of unknown, because we don't really have a whole lot of information on that, although I did point out the four deuterocanonical texts, which can shed some light on that. In regard to the Book of Enoch, I would just say that in the Orthodox tradition, for example, there's no problem with there being true oral tradition outside of the written canonical texts. So, for example, in the Orthodox tradition, we have an appreciation of the Proto-Evangelium of James, which has a tradition about Mary as the Theotokos and other ideas about her, even though it's not part of the strict biblical canon. And this is because the New Testament has many places where we're told that the apostles taught the word of God. In many places, we don't know what that was. Paul taught in Ephesus for 3 years, day and night. We don't have a written record of all the things that he taught, but he tells Timothy in the letters to Timothy to pass on that oral tradition to people that he would then lay hands on after him. So that body of teaching, that catechesis that Paul gave, he instructs Timothy to also pass all that on. But we only have two letters of Paul to to Timothy at Ephesus. So there's a tradition, we would say, that is still there. And there's nothing inherently bad about it being oral. God was able to preserve the oral tradition from Adam to Moses. So there's no reason why he can't still preserve oral teaching and oral tradition. In fact, in 2 Thessalonians, Paul enjoins the church of Thessaloniki to pass on the traditions that he taught, whether oral or written. So we have a standing command to continue to do that in the churches. And the Orthodox Church, of course, believes that, as does the Catholic Church as well. So point being here, the New Testament texts that refer to tradition can also be a little more flexible when it comes to these other books that have been continuously mentioned, not just the Book of Enoch, but other books like the Book of Jasher, or the Book of the Wars of the Lord. Some of those we don't have. They've been lost to history, but they're referred to within the scriptures as genuine traditions. And so there's a less hardline view than perhaps Protestant, classical Protestants or evangelicals have about the limitations of the canon of Scripture. And so the canon of Scripture was determined many centuries later in the 6th and 7th century of the history of the church, not in the 1st and 2nd century. And if you read about the history of the canon, you'll begin to understand that. You could read Lee MacDonald's book, Formation of the Biblical Canon. You could read F.F. Bruce's book, the Canon of Scripture, and those are evangelical Protestants that are admitting a lot of these points that I'm giving you when it comes to the canon itself. Now, to get back to the watchers and the angels, the Book of Enoch can have true traditions and true ideas within it, and thus it can be referenced in the Book of Jude, and it doesn't have to be within the biblical canon, right? Because there's a certain status or tier that being included within the canon carries with it. And even within the canon, we have a level of importance, right? The deuterocanonical texts, hence why they're called a secondary canon, they're not as important as the Gospels. Doesn't mean that they're wrong or that they're evil or false. It just means that they're not the highest of importance in a tier. And that's why in the liturgy, whether Catholic or Orthodox, the Gospels are always given a preeminent place even above the Pauline epistles. Doesn't mean Paul's teaching false. It just means that that it's a more important text. So likewise, outside of the canonical tradition, there can be actual traditions, things like what's in the Book of Jude, or excuse me, what's in the Book of Enoch, cited in the Book of Jude, and it can still be true. And so it's entirely plausible to hold to the angel thesis. And if we have that thesis and we look at the Book of Daniel when it talks about the watchers who have this certain role of being angelic beings that are instructed to kind of govern over certain nations and certain areas and whatnot, we have this story within Daniel of Gabriel having to interact with another angelic being. And there was a spiritual sort of warfare going on between the Prince of Persia, not an actual human being, but presumably an angelic entity or a fallen angelic entity that Gabriel had to interact with. And we see this, of course, throughout the Old Testament as well. There's many places where we're told that when the fall happened, many of the nations fell under the governance of some of these fallen angelic beings. And so the gospel, when it goes out in the New Testament, becomes a period of the conquering of the nations, spiritually speaking, to the religion and worship of Christ, right? So this warfare, this God is a man of war, so to speak, where Christ is going forth conquering, not necessarily with like physical, tanks and horses, but conquering through the preaching of the gospel, right? The sword that proceeds from his mouth is the preaching of the gospel. And it spiritually conquers the nations such that the demonic entities under which the nations had fallen in terms of worshiping idolatry, the idolatrous worship that all the nations fell into, that is being destroyed in this spiritual battle through the catechesis and the baptizing of the nations and bringing them into the church, which has been happening for 2,000 years. So if we think about this, we could begin to place the alien story of today within this structure of a spiritual cosmic battle. This is the Alex Jones Show, and I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis.
When Barack Obama's birth certificate came out, and I went to the government website, I downloaded the birth certificate, I put it into Adobe Photoshop, I separated the layers, and I thought, this is crazy. They released a fake birth certificate. I didn't need somebody to tell me that. I didn't need, I didn't read somebody say that and just believe it on trust of them. I did it myself. I saw it with my own eyes. I did it with my own hands. And then I tell my friend, he's like, that's racist, right? I'm like, what? No, I just did it. And they're like, it's like a racist conspiracy theory, right? You're like, what? What is going on? So if you've experienced that, the reason is some people do not have the chemical balance to handle things like that. You need a lot of testosterone to handle things like that. You need to have your mind not warped and distorted by the dopamine feedback loop that social media is designed to create in your brain to enforce you into the pre-established, preordained, approved of mindset. So if you're here, you probably already are winning the chemical war over your own body, but that's why we sell the supplements that we do. Pretty much everybody takes up. Who doesn't take vitamins? Who doesn't supplement in some way or another? Who doesn't add a protein scoop when they get a smoothie at the store or take vitamin D or vitamin C or fish oil, you know, before bed or you know, when you wake up? Isn't a crazy thing. This isn't an out there woo-woo type of thing. Everybody takes supplements. Everybody I know takes supplements. And if you're not, you should be. And so all we do is get the best supplements on the market, white label them. And so you get them from us, you're probably getting a better price than at the store. And you're absolutely getting the best possible quality of all of these products. If you're here for the first time and don't know why you would support us, because you get the information for free, because the streams are free, because there's no obligation for you to support us, that's all part of the strategy. The fact is, we're able to keep this free because you go to thealexjonesstore.com. Put this information into action. You have to understand the attack on humanity itself and then fight back against it in two different ways. One, by advocating and trying to seize power politically to change things from the top down. But while that's going on, you've got to be protecting yourself against this stuff. And we have a lot of supplements and vitamins and minerals and merchandise for you to do exactly that. Things like Atomic Defense, Methylene Blue, Methylene Red. These things are extremely powerful and combat exactly the type of poisons that we talk about on a continual basis. So I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not making claims here. I'm not saying it's going to, you know, cure any diseases or anything. But I'm saying that in the modern world, it's microplastics and, atrazine and herbicides and growth hormones and fluoride that they put in the water on purpose because they want you dumb. You have to combat these things. You have to be protecting yourself and building up your internal shield so you can even handle the information that we're bringing to you. And that really is a thing. Testosterone, the higher your testosterone is, the more likely you are to go against the grain, to reject the herd mentality of the crowd, and instead pursue justice or pursue the truth, regardless of who says anything about it. And there's a chemical balance that has to be achieved there. But that's why there's such an attempt to lower your IQ, lower your testosterone, lower your masculinity, lower your self-sufficiency, lower your self-confidence. Because they want you a tired, weak, overwhelmed, overworked slave. That's what the people in power have designed this world to do to you. And you don't have to take it. You can fight back. You can protect yourself. You can reverse the effects of the damage that's done to your body as it is to all of our bodies by going to the Alex Jones store and getting a product.
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.
Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis, and we are discussing the placement of the idea of the fallen angelic beings in the cosmic scope of the history of the world and the battle between the forces of good and evil, the fallen angelic beings and the human beings that are aligned with them versus the people of God and those that are aligned with the sons of God and Christ, the man of war. Speaking of that, Father Stephen DeYoung, I noticed, was just on Tucker, and he's written several books that are really good in this regard. They were talking about Genesis 6 and the Nephilim, so this actually providentially all tied in really well. And he's got some good books that cover this, including The Religion of the Apostles, which is a good book that I'm reading right now. I recommend that. But as we move up into the modern era, as we see these phenomena begin to really pop off, the so-called alien UFO phenomenon, the abductions and the entities and whatnot. One of the first things that I remember noticing when I began to study this phenomena, I would say back in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, read a whole bunch of books on UFOs and alien abductions and what exactly is going on in this phenomena. And one of the first books that I came across was actually a Protestant evangelical guy who wrote a really good book in, I want to say, the late 90s and 2004, excuse me. And it's called Alien Intrusion. And in this book, Gary Bates posits the thesis that the alien story, the alien mythos, is curiously very close to the sort of New World Order evolutionary atheist mythos. It's almost like a kind of a metaphysical religious replacement mythology to replace the idea of biblical religion with something akin to we are the offspring of the gods. We've been seeded here by the aliens, and the ancient aliens are actually coming back to farm us and genetically experiment on us, and really just a bunch of nonsense that matches up very closely with the atheistic, Darwinistic, social Darwinist type of message, which perfectly plays into the technocratic New World Order elite plans to have a global government, a culling of the population, a mass disarmament, one world government, one world, religion. All of those things just happen to be the message that the aliens and the ancient aliens and the visitors and whatever you want to call it, the interdimensional beings. Well, that's always what they want. Why? Why are they always saying what happens to be the global elite message, right? We got to cut the population. We got to corral everybody into smart cities. We got to control everything. We got to disarm, right? We got to get rid of guns. Like, that's literally what the aliens are always telling us. And this was some of the first propaganda in early alien movies that Hollywood was putting out. If you go back and watch The Day the Earth Stood Still, you'll notice that that was actually consulted on by the OSS and CIA. People like C.D. Jackson, others were involved in producing these films that would teach scientific socialism against the idea of nation states and having arms, right? So they had a disarmament message that only through a United Nations style socialist world government could we ever overcome warfare, which is preposterous because, I mean, socialism and Marxism are actually the sources of most of the 20th century's warfare. Atheism, Marxism, socialism dominate the destruction of the chaos of the 20th century, but somehow these are going to be the savior solution, models for how to overcome global warfare and to create global peace. But Gary Bates noted a long time ago that this was also presenting a kind of a false gospel. Another interesting text that I read over many years studying this phenomena was something you might not expect. And this ties into a lengthy live stream that we did last night. My wife and I, we covered the history of tantrism and tantric Buddhism. And you might think, well, what does that have to do with aliens and this sort of nonsense? Well, it turns out the idea of the gods and the visitation of the deities and entities on chariots and whatnot, in many cases in the ancient and pagan world, that was accompanied by or facilitated by very powerful drugs, very powerful hallucinogens, whether it's ancient, whether it's shamanic tribes using Ibogaine or whatever, or using entheogens. All of this oftentimes would occur through the shaman going into the other dimensions and interacting with the deities, the entities that come and visit in chariots, as the Bhagavad Gita says, or they come and visit in these ships that are described by, like flying airships that the shaman would describe on his journeys or his vision quest to the other side. And in many of those stories, the shaman would describe a kind of ritual dismemberment that he would undergo. So to be initiated into the shamanic tradition, this is, by the way, is almost global. There's a great book by, I think it's Mircea Eliade, the religious scholar, famous Romanian religious scholar, who wrote a book on shamanism and the whole history of shamanism. And he was noting that all across the world in these disparate cultures, there's a commonality to the ritual initiation journey that the shaman undergoes when he's on these very powerful hallucinogens. And there's a death, burial, resurrection process. But what often happens is when he dies or when he goes into the spiritual realm, the gods or the interdimensional entities actually dismember him and consume him. And then in some cases, he sort of vomited back up into being a resurrected new being. And so when he comes out of the trip out of the shamanic journey or the shamanic process, he's been ritually initiated into being resurrected. And now he has his third sight. He has his higher eye, his third eye opened. This is very common, again, all throughout the world. Why would there be this common death, burial, dismemberment, and then resurrection motif if there wasn't something to this idea? But this is a kind of dark demonic initiation. And what's interesting is that when you cover that, when you look into that, and then you look into the tendency of what people describe in alien abduction scenarios, or compare that with sleep paralysis experiments or experiences that people have, or when you compare that to ritual abuse cases, SRA, that kind of stuff, and when you look at MK Ultra, well, lo and behold, there just tends to be a lot of these commonalities. But what a lot of people don't know is that some of that, or much of that, comes out of things like the tantric Tibetan Buddhist experience, because Tibetan Buddhism, it's not just about yoga chicks and yoga pants and Instagram. It's actually about the denigration of the self in order to achieve enlightenment through undergoing the left-hand path, right? So when you hear about this in the occult world of the left-hand path and the right-hand path, that actually comes out of things like Tibetan Buddhism and these hermetic, Eastern hermetic traditions. Amongst the tantric tradition, you have the idea that the woman is a battery that has to have her life force sucked out of her, and she must then be discarded and denigrated. And they also have within that tradition a very prevalent use of younger people, if you catch my drift. This helps to explain why we see the Dalai Lama slurping on kids, as Theo Vaughn said. Why would that exist? Well, in that tradition, you have to negate and destroy the self. You have to engage in all the most horrendous practices, everything from cannibalism to incest, in order to overcome the attachments and the desires to become above good and evil, right? And in that process, there are many cases where you're meeting the deities, you're interacting with the deities, right? This is, again, part of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And I realize that, like, other normal Buddhism is different from the Tibetan tradition, but this is relevant for America and for the West, because the Eastern ideas that have so penetrated the West, whether it's yoga or tantra or whatever, this was actually engineered and fostered by very wealthy and elite people. I'm not just talking about people like Helena Blavatsky, but the other people at the UN as well, Alice Bailey, Annie Besant, and particularly Blavatsky, because she's one of the pioneers of pushing yoga and meditation in the West, which was formerly seen as something, confined to India and places like that. But it was designed to come into the West because there was a guy at the 1895, I think it's 1895, Chicago's World Fair named Swami Vivekananda. And he taught a religion of introducing the West to yoga, meditation, kundalini, because all the religions are the same. And they're all manifestations of the one, Atman, Brahman, etc. And so Jesus, yeah, he's cool, but he's just one of the many deities out there. And there was a famous person named Granddaddy Rockefeller who was very enamored with this message of Swami Vivekananda, not so much because he himself was spiritually moved. He was a teetotaler Baptist, but he understood that, wait a minute, this could actually be very, very beneficial to oligarchical designs. A religion where everybody accepts all the religions is the ultimate perfect religion. And if a powerful, oligarchic, wealthy elite could control and steer that, that would be a way to actually unify all the churches and all the religions into a controlled fake religion, the supra religion, right? The mega church. I don't just mean the Joel Osteen mega church. I mean the mega church of all the churches and all the religions of them as a manifestation of the one. That is the lie of Hinduism that this elite family explicitly puts in their authorized biography, which I've been covering for the first time I ever called in Alex Jones in 2007. I called in to talk about that. I said, I've been reading the Rockefeller's biography, and they talk about wanting to create a one world religion that's an ecumenist, secretist extravaganza. And this is based on what he was taught by Swami Vivekananda at the Chicago World's Fair. And this births the modern ecumenist movement and the World Council of Churches, National Council of Churches idea, which is all a Rockefeller funded thing, to create and to unify all the churches under the false banner of all the religions are essentially the same. They're all just gradations and tiers of manifestations of the one. And so we get this false religion that's being promoted, which is, I would say right now, kind of a proto false one world religion that will emerge. What exactly that will look like? Will it be Chrislam? Will it be sort of Judaic? Will it be New Age? Will it be Hindu? It remains to be seen exactly what direction that will go when we get towards the end times, whenever that is. But regardless, we know that there are oligarchical designs behind this. And in fact, many of the mouthpieces like H.G. Wells of these elites, of this Royal Society, Fabian Socialist type elite, they wrote books saying the type of religion that they would concoct. H.G. Wells has a book called God, the Invisible King, where he says that the future religion is not atheism. It's a kind of scientific, scientism-based Luciferianism. He says it will be the worship of Lucifer. You have similar types of statements amongst many New Agers and others, and even Aleister Crowley himself, who was a huge fan of Madame Blavatsky. In fact, he would direct his devotees to read Madame Blavatsky, and her philosophy is what underlies modern public schooling. She was very influential in that. It's the philosophy at the Lucis Trust of the United Nations. It's the philosophy and the idea of theosophy that's promoted throughout a lot of the West. And again, she really introduced yoga to the West. But what people don't realize is that the real secrets of yoga are actually, well, let's just put it bluntly. It's a lot of the same types of sexual practices that Crowley talked about. But in the case of Tantric Buddhism, it's all about not actually releasing in the woman or in the person. It's actually about just holding that in and retaining all of that as you suck in the energy of the woman and become a powerful mystic, right? So it's really bizarre stuff, but you could tell, well, wait a minute, that's exactly the type of stuff that's in Numbers when the Israelites are at Baal Peor. Yeah, and where does that all come from? It's the demonic inverted rituals and religion that the demons and the fallen angels have been promoting and entrapping human beings with for millennia. It's the exact same. And what's a better explanation for this? That human beings just have a tendency to get degenerate? But why that? It's just the grossest stuff that you could think of. Well, doesn't it make a lot of sense if there's actually spiritual beings and entities that promote these types of practices? Now, to go back to Tibetan Buddhism, many years ago, I covered the Psychonauts in a lot of their books, and particularly Timothy Leary, right? Timothy Leary was, of course, putting out and promoting LSD on behalf of the CIA by design for many years. And he really helped to kick off the 1960s countercultural revolution. In fact, he takes credit for this in many YouTube videos that you can look up. And he also says that he believed that he was continuing the work of Aleister Crowley. He was a devotee of Crowleyanism. And you could debate how deep or how serious he was into all that. But his depths of LSD obsession and having done LSD so many, I think he died on his deathbed. He was tripping, right? But he wrote a book that a lot of people are not aware of called The Psychedelic Experience and how it's a manual of traversing this vision quest based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And in this book, Leary theorizes, I've read a bunch of Timothy Leary, by the way, and I've also had bad acid trips and good acid trips. And by good, I mean that it wasn't it wasn't a bad one. I'm not promoting it, but I'm saying, so I'm familiar with the psychedelic experience. I've done it firsthand. I understand what's going on. And when you read a lot of these books, you will notice that as well. Leary is basically saying that the psychonaut, the person who's done the trips many times and who then studies the Tibetan Book of the Dead, can actually use this as a manual to be like a shaman to control and to initiate people into the vision quest and into the psychedelic experience. In other words, you become a kind of a handler. You can become a guru. It's a manual kind of in becoming a guru and initiating people through the Tibetan Book of the Dead experience. Now, again, notice the pattern here. You're going to lead people through a ritual initiation process. The LSD experience is very potent, very powerful. And you're going to be taking them through this death, burial, resurrection journey. I don't even remember there is a resurrection journey here. But for Timothy Leary, he says, this is a way to teach you to be a shamanic initiator and how to lead people through this journey to, in a sense, resurrect by becoming enlightened out of this journey, right? But what happens in this journey is that you will encounter things that many other Satanists and other religious practitioners like Aleister Crowley talk about. For example, you will reach the abyss. You will cross the void of the abyss. And eventually you will come to greater and greater levels of enlightenment as you pass through these phases of the beyond, to become beyond distinction, to realize that you are one with all. You eventually will be embraced in a kind of blinding white light, which I would say, you know, Paul says Lucifer appears as an angel of light. I would not say that this is the uncreated light of God. It's the created light of Lucifer, which dupes a lot of people. And he says that all this really will lead you into understanding that the gods and the devils that you will encounter are actually the same thing as the aliens that people are describing today. So it was actually Timothy Leary basing himself on Crowleyan ideas. And there's books like Weston's book on Aleister Crowley and the occult, where there's whole chapters that Crowley's whole ethos, or Crowley's whole idea of Lamb, or the deity that he thought he was encountering. If you've probably seen Lamb, he's that guy that looks like a gray. It's one of the earliest depictions of an alien. He looks just like the aliens of today. And Crowley talked about that 100 years ago. You'll notice that extraterrestrial gnosis is essentially what's going on in the Crowleyan tradition. And here you have the popularizer of Crowley in the 1960s to all the boomers. They didn't even realize they were being initiated in a Crowleyan initiation. All the boomers participating in the counterculture revolution that thought they were getting free from the system, man. Oh, I'm not a slave to the man, man. Meanwhile, you're really just undergoing the same thing that every pagan religion has ever done for millennia, right? So the psychedelic experience is what? Aliens. It's about contacting and interacting with aliens. And the gods and the demons of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, according to Leary, are aliens. And Leary himself says, hey, it's just like an alien abduction. When you undergo the Tibetan Book of the Dead acid trip under me as your guru shaman, guess what? It's the same as alien abduction stories. What people describe who think that they're being abducted by aliens or whatever's happening, it's the exact same as the demons that you're encountering. And he even calls them demons. He's like, yeah, you're going to see demons. You're going to see spirits. You're going to see all this kind of stuff. And he even says that, yeah, they're probably going to cannibalize you and eat you. He says at a certain point when you get into the journey, he calls it the third bardo, the period of reentry, Sidpa bardo, the cannibal gods or demons will arrive. They will rip your skin off and eat it. But don't worry about it, dude. This was part of the initiation. And then after you've been dismembered and ingested and destroyed and vomited back up, like I said about the shamanic tradition, you will become empty, non-being, and the void. You become the void. And then there's a whole poem, which I, if I recall, is part of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where you are the void. And I think Agent Dale Cooper in Twin Peaks even sources and cites this, by the way. So the light that you experience is the light of the void. It's the dark light of the dark enlightenment. And it's a kind of evil apophaticism where you become totally negated and become non-being. And then you are reborn as an empty vessel to be a more pure manifestation of the one. You're basically to be possessed. This is the goal here, right? It's not about being a manifestation of some generic one. It's actually about these entities stepping into you and becoming the thing that drives you. that's what Timothy Leary describes the LSD experience truly as. That's the true spiritual underlying LSD experience, according to Tim Leary. And again, these are people who completely revolutionized all of Western culture through the 1960s boomer counterculture experiments, right? And they were not doing it for fun. They were doing it because they were devotees of Aleister Crowley and because they were intent on completely revolutionizing the West into a new aeon or a new era. And it's intimately tied up with the alien UFO experience. The Crowleyans tend to identify the beings and the gods that you're contacting with aliens, ETs, and UFOs explicitly over and over and over in their texts. Again, the whole idea of a gray, the little gray alien with the big eyes and the tiny chin and the big head, it's exactly parallel to Crowley's deity called Lamb that he was supposedly channeling. And who was Lamb? Lamb is supposedly a llama, a ascended master Himalayan llama that Crowley thought he was. It's just a demonic entity. But another one of the psychonauts who was instrumental in the MKUltra projects, the guy who had a weird sexual fascination with dolphins, Dr. John C. Lilly, who wrote about dosing children with LSD and reprogramming them in his book, Programming and Metaprogramming in the Human Biocomputer. Well, in his biography, John C. Lilly, the scientist's metaphysical autobiography, guess who wrote the introduction? Oh, it's Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary wrote the introduction and said, what we're doing with MKUltra and LSD is bringing in a new Aleister Crowley era, a new aeon. And then John C. Lilly himself, after describing things like implantable microchips and that they were doing this as part of naval research in the 1950s. They were doing this in the 1940s and 50s. There's a whole page on ELF, VLF, frequency manipulation studies that he was involved in. They were putting chips in monkey brains a long time ago. Here's a whole thing, studying the brain waves, the Lilly wave. When they put the chips in monkeys, they probably put it in humans too. It wasn't just monkeys, but monkeys. And then he talks about the conferences that he would have. He would take high doses of, I want to say all kinds of drugs. I want to say like ketamine, LSD, you name it. And he would do the float tanks, right? So he would go in the float tanks, there's a whole chapter on this. And he would be super dosed up and he would have concourse with the beings who would give him information and ideas about technology. And it just so happens that he thinks and calls them ETs and aliens. He thinks he was talking to aliens. This is the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer. Now, let's go to my channel on YouTube, Jay Dyer. Go to the Alex Jones store and get those products. Go to jaysanalysis.com in the shop and buy my books, signed copies of Esoteric Hollywood 1, 2, and 3.
Folks, I'm Dr. Bigley. Today's presentation will be about methylene blue and you.
Dr. Bigley, what does methylene blue do?
Great question, Billy. It has to do with your mitochondria, the powerhouse of your cells. Let's bring out the mitochondria now!
Right.
As I was saying, methylene blue supercharges your mitochondria, which does wonders for your mental clarity, stamina, and overall pep. Just look at him go!
Gee, Dr. Bigley, he must have drank a lot of methylene blue. He was bouncing off the walls.
Right you are, Billy. He sure drank a lot. Let's continue, shall we?
Billy, did you know that methylene blue can cure communism?
No, sir. Can I see?
Why, certainly, Billy. Take a look over there.
Behold, Ivan, a Ruski doggedly determined to undermine our way of life. Careful, Billy. He bites. Oh. Look, vodka, potato hooch. Watch. The communism is slowly leaving his body.
Wow, the methylene blue cured the red right out of him.
So, how do you feel?
Gee, Doc, I don't know what got into me. I feel like $1 million now. Say, where can I get some more of that blue stuff in case I become retarded again?
You can find it on the alexjonesstore.com.
What does .com mean?
Days, weeks, and even years ahead of the news cycle, AlexJonesLive.com is tomorrow's news today.